I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Dr. Willie Parker describes in his new book the public shaming that unmarried pregnant girls and young women in his church had to endure, standing in front of the congregation begging for forgiveness. This was when he was a young man himself growing up in rural Alabama. The book is titled Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. It's about his childhood, being the first in his family to go to college and then medical school, and his decision to devote his practice to providing abortions, largely for poor women of color in the South. He also writes about the power of his Christian faith to inform his work, influenced by Martin Luther King's sermon about the Good Samaritan. Dr. Parker calls that a moment of conversion. He's the chair of the board for Physicians for Reproductive Health, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. And nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your book, the first paragraph from the prologue.
Happy to. Prologue's entitled The Women. At 6:30 a.m. on procedure day, the abortion clinic waiting room at Reproductive Health Services in Montgomery, Alabama, is as hushed as a church. Inside, beyond the bulletproof doors, the women are waiting for me, occupying every vinyl-covered chair, occasionally perched on windowsills. 25, 30, as many as 50 women sometimes. When I pass through the room in my street clothes, the uniform of sweats, baseball cap, and prescription shades that allow me to hide in plain sight, most of them won't even look up. But occasionally, a woman will have heard of me, the, quote, nice black doctor at this clinic, and she'll meet my eyes with a smile. She may believe that I'm going to get her through this, whatever, quote, this means to her, and hope that by making contact with a glance, she will show me that she is an individual with a story and reasons and dreams of her own.
You go on to write that you see your work as an abortion provider as doing God's work. Explain what you mean.
Well, I think as a Christian and as someone with a understanding of a higher power and feeling an obligation to respond to participate in life, I see abortion as a biologic reality and as a condition that is unique to women related to their biology of reproduction and that it happens in their body. And I see, as a human being, I'm called to a humanity to be involved. And I think the deepest expression of love towards your fellow human being, as commanded by God, in my understanding, is to show compassion mm-hmm. for them in their time of need. So I have not found a place in reality, in my understanding, where we stand be. There's no place where a person who is in need is stands beyond the love of God. And for me, that means in the abortion, in the room where I perform abortions, that's no different. So, as a women's health provider, I'm my chosen craft is to provide women's health care. Abortion is women's health care. So I feel compelled to do that work.
You write about growing up in a religious family, about being born again. I mean, clearly, religion has played a big role in your life. You describe yourself as a person of faith. You also describe a story from the Gospel of John about the adulteress and what you think Jesus was thinking at the time. And you also describe the sermon that Martin Luther King did where he described the story of the Good Samaritan. And that seemed to be this true moment of conversion for you. How so?
Well, I had grown up with a traditional religious understanding in the South, and that meant that my approach to the sacred text was one of biblical literalism. And while my conversion predated the whole pro-life, pro-choice narrative, I'd never really been taught that abortion was wrong. But it was sort of inferred, given that most women if they had an unplanned pregnancy, they were expected to continue that. And so I just was never against abortion, but was unclear about what it meant to me to provide it once I chose to become a women's health provider. And so I found myself facing women who needed this care, but I found myself unable to provide it. And so, as Dr. King said in another passage, at the end of your life, at the end of the day, the most important question will be, what have you done for others? And I found myself increasingly unable to say no to women when they presented to me with unplanned, unwanted pregnancies or wanted, belatedly flawed ones. And I was in the midst of a crisis where I was in a clinical situation where women were being denied this access after it had been available. And so at that moment, while listening to this sermon where Dr. King described what made the Good Samaritan good, I had my crisis moment. It really became more important to me about how will I respond to a human need and perceived injustice when it comes before me. And I just couldn't look away. And that meant for me as a woman's health provider that it became morally important and morally required for me to respond to the needs of my patients in the form of abortion care.
You even describe you had a sister who got pregnant, and you and some others raising money to try to figure out how to get her an abortion or try to somehow help her. She decided to have the baby. But you also talked about, you were a younger person at that time, but you also talked about the kind of judgments you had of her for getting herself into this predicament.
Sure. The earliest school experience I had with one of my classmates being pregnant and becoming a mother was seventh grade. And so I'd seen young women have babies. I knew where babies came from. And somehow in my mind, I was always more forgiving and accepting of those young women in my community. But when my 14-year-old sister became pregnant by one of my friends who eventually became my brother-in-law, somehow for me, it was that whole notion of charity should begin at home and spread abroad, but for me, that was reversed. I was more charitable towards people than I was towards my own sister. And
you judged her harshly.
I judged her harshly, and I didn't say anything mean to her, but I knew my approval meant a lot to her, so I said nothing at all to her. And that was very cruel. And so part of my recovery and part of my restitution was to be there for other women when I had my epiphany. And so my sister became an additional impetus for me to do the work. But we have a very beautiful relationship. But, you know, Muhammad Ali said that if a man thinks the same way at 50 as he did at 20, he's wasted the last 30 years. So I know better, and now I do better.
Well, and there's this whole theme of shame that really runs through your book as you see it. Mm-hmm. Women getting pregnant and being shamed for that. Sure. Women choosing to have an abortion and being shamed for that as well. How much does that drive you?
It drives me, it's almost the essential impetus for me to do this work because it is a stratification of humanity by sex and gender. In my Christian understanding, God is no respecter of persons nor of gender. And so it drives me to the point of it informs me in the way that when Abraham Lincoln was asked why he freed the slaves, obviously the Civil War is fought for many reasons, but he said simply, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. And what that has meant for me in terms of thinking about women being denied their agency that is rooted in their humanity, that I will not knowingly participate in systems of oppression that deny women their agency and their humanity and their equality. So that meant as a man, understanding the ways in which I'm privileged, and as a healer and a healthcare provider, and as a Christian, that in all the ways that I look at the disparities by gender, I've simply chosen not to participate in that, and I've done what I can to deconstruct that gendered understanding of humanity.
You have focused largely on low-income women of color in the South. I realize your practice has been more than that, but in many ways, that has been the focus of a lot of your work. What don't we understand about the condition these women sometimes find themselves in?
Well, we don't understand that unplanned pregnancy happens to all women, irrespective of their race, gender, and socioeconomic status. 50% of all pregnancies in this country are unintended. Unintended does not mean unwanted. And well over half of those unintended pregnancies will continue, but the ones that don't end up in abortion. And since unintended pregnancies are what cause abortion, unintended pregnancies are more common in women who have less education, lack of access to medically accurate sex education, lack of access to reliable health care, lack of access to modern contraception. And those conditions disproportionately occur to people of color and poor folk. So I figured that one of the key themes of the gospel is to bring relief to the oppressed. And
you see them as oppressed?
I do, by no fault of their own, that we accept economic material disparity on the basis of race I figured, as a person committed to social justice, if I can't make those people a priority, when I say those people, I'm no longer poor. I'm still stigmatized in some ways because of my skin color. But as a person of color and from the ranks of poverty, if I can't make them a priority, who will? If they're better off, if poor people have what they need, it's a given. If we really believe that rising tides sink raises all ships, why don't we raise the poorest with the understanding that everybody else is going to be okay?
But you also write that well-educated women who are part of your practice ended up having an unintended pregnancy, wanting an abortion, that they were not largely, but surprisingly ignorant of all the things you describe for poor women of color about birth control, about how their body works. What explains that, do you think?
I think we have a crisis of health illiteracy, and you know, I know that's a freighted term. Illiteracy usually kind of implies that people are stupid. People aren't stupid, but in a society that's strangely schizophrenic about human sexuality, we use sex to sell things. We do it. We talk about it, but we don't want to give information so that people can make responsible decisions around it. And so I think we're in a crisis of health illiteracy, given that we don't permit medically accurate, stage-appropriate sex education in our schools in the way they do in other countries. And as a result of Scandinavian countries, they have a fraction of the unintended pregnancy rates, particularly for teens, that we do. And so it is this schizophrenia we have around sexuality that plagues us all because we all are impaired in our access to this basic health information that should be empowering.
About a minute before our break here, were you also part of that at some point in your life? The kind of scarlet letter of unintended sexuality or unintended pregnancy?
Part of my experience is informed by the fact that I had a partner who experienced an unintended pregnancy once. But more importantly, as a medical student who was sexually active, I had a girlfriend who was in medical school where the condom broke. And she was definitely afraid that I was going to abandon her if there was a pregnancy. There wasn't one, but being somebody who was highly educated and who was very responsible and having exposure to an unintended pregnancy made me aware that people who don't have the resources that I had are no different from me. And in fact, I had every chance and still had this possibility of becoming a father before I was ready. Just think of people who have no chance of taking control of their reproductive lives. So that also informs how I practice the care that I provide.
Well, let's take that break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Dr. Willie Parker. He's got a new book. It's called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. He is chair of the Board of Physicians for Reproductive Health, and talking about his faith and also his decision to provide abortions, especially for poor women of color. He's been working largely in the South. Lines open. Call or text our comment line, 267-405-2006. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking with Dr. Willie Parker. He is a OBGYN. He provides abortions and has been doing abortions for young or women of color, I should say, in the South most recently. And he's got a new book called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And again, you can join our conversation by texting or calling our comment line, 267-405-2006. I can't tell you how many programs I've done about abortion over the last 30 years or so. And it does feel as if we just, whatever, if there is something in the middle where people who oppose abortion and people support abortion can come together, it seems to me it has to do with birth control, the idea of figuring out how to prevent unwanted pregnancies in the first place. As someone who's been on the front lines of this, is there some middle ground you think that people can come together on?
You would think that people could come together over contraception, but the people who are extreme on the issue of reproduction and want to leave it in the space of magical thinking are just as opposed to contraception, which befuddles me. How can you be opposed to abortion and contraception? The middle ground approach, while I think it makes sense in terms of trying to bring about more civility over this public issue. The middle ground approach often requires a concession on both sides, but it is hard to make that conception when there's a false equivocation. The whole pro-life and pro-choice narrative makes it seem like it's a matter of opinion, but if you want to frame the argument accurately, it's abortion rights and anti-abortion rights, which then requires you to deal with the facts of the reality. So I think the middle ground cannot be the goal, you know, because it also is predicated upon, in my opinion, quite possibly a false equivocation about the positions of where people stand on abortion.
Well, let me pick up, because I certainly have had people on the show, guests on the show, have said from their perspective, life begins at conception, and that abortion is the same as murder. Interestingly, they say the doctor is the murderer, and they don't hold the woman responsible, sure, even if she were to choose an abortion. You push back really hard on this notion of life beginning at conception.
Sure. Well, I stand in respect and in honest disagreement, because the Mahatma Gandhi says honest disagreement is the beginning of progress. And so where I start when people say that to me, I said, you know, I respect you hold that opinion, but that's a non-biologic understanding of reproduction and my science. And what's irrefutable is the fact that in order for there to be a live conceptus, you have to have a live egg and a live sperm. You can't have a dead egg and a dead sperm and get a live conception. So that obviously means life begins before conception. Hmm. And so if you want to look at life more philosophically, life is a process and not an event. Life, as you describe it, began a long time ago, whether you think we evolved or we were placed here by a divine purpose. But what it means is that life is a process of beginnings and endings, and they play out whether you personally participate or not. The world goes on whether you individually decide to procreate or not. Life begins and life ends. And so I think if we're going to talk about life in the concept of reproduction, let's be clear about whether or not we're having a scientific, evidence-based conversation or a religious and philosophic one.
So when then does life begin for you, from your as a OBGYN?
Well, one of my friends said, his mother is Jewish. She said, life begins when you graduate from college and have a job. And that's not a Jewish joke, but it's just an interesting perspective.
For
me, the whole notion of life is like a, you know, life is a play. It's an interaction of many things. Death is a part of life, you know, beginnings and endings. You know, when we talk about if all conceptions have purpose, only 28% of pregnancies end up in a live birth. There's the miscarriage rate is 12%. If you say that there's purpose in everything, there are built-in biologic inefficiencies in reproduction. And the purpose that those things take on in large part is what you assign to them. And I understand that people, based on their religious understanding or whatever sacred text they subscribe to, they are trying to assign meaning to these processes that play out. So for me, life is a series and a complex of interactions of beginnings, endings, and other determinants that just happens, you know, and what set the ball in play, we all can debate about that. But, I have a philosophic and a biologic understanding of life, and I've actively sought to deconstruct the false partition between those two.
You describe walking the perp walk, those are your words, when you're going to work, as you are, I guess, passing by people who are opposed to abortion that are either shouting or saying things to the people that work at the clinic or the women who are going there to get an abortion. Do you worry for your own life, knowing I think four doctors have been murdered since Roe became law?
Well, somebody once said you can't be brave unless you're scared. And I look at fear. Fear is a homeostatic mechanism, if you let me use medical language for a second, because it is your fight or flight response that has evolved or that you were imbued with as a human being. And so if you ignore your instincts around safety, you are at risk. Mm-hmm. I would be silly to not be mindful of the fact that there are people who are deeply philosophically and literally opposed to abortion. And some of them are so much so to the point of being homicidal about it. So I'm not in denial about that. The only person who's been killed since I became an abortion provider is Dr. Tiller, whom I had the chance to meet. So I didn't enter into this with a sense of hoping that things were going to be safer or less risky. I understand that, you know, you have to have something that you're committed to and you live for. And Dr. King said it best, and I take a lot of instruction from people who have ultimately lost their lives by obeying a higher purpose. He says, if you don't have something that you stand for and live for, even if you die 50 years after you have to decide to pursue life versus your purpose, it's just a belated announcement of what something's already died. So I'm more afraid of a death of spirit and a loss of purpose than I am that someone would actually physically try and harm me.
I mean, not to be overly melodramatic here. I mean, you're willing to die for your practice?
I'm willing to die as a function of living because I've decided that life is fatal. None of us are getting out alive. Mm-hmm. And I'm not suicidal, so I really don't have any control over when I die. I just have control over how I live. And I have every intention of living long, but living long, I also have every intention of living well. I can control one of those. I can't control how long I live, but I can control how well and purposefully I live. And so that has my attention more than the fact that somebody might try and harm me.
You describe, and this is the law in many states, about the waiting periods, things that you have to tell a young woman or a woman who's interested in having an abortion. You say in Mississippi that having an abortion increases a risk for breast cancer, even though that is not true, as you say. Mm-hmm. And I think the research proves that out. But by law, you are required to say that to a woman.
I am. I think it's I'm of the opinion that the truth will do. And so I'm perplexed by the fact that in the quest to protect women from their own decisions, there's an intent to misinform them and to terrorize them out of making their own decisions. Now, I can be obligated by law to give whatever information that they mandate me to give, and the decision that I have to make when facing that requirement is, what is the greater good? The greater good is I can, on the basis of principle, ignore the law, be in violation of it, and then be prohibited from providing abortion care. Or I can practice medicine, which allows me to interact with facts and to interpret them in my best medical opinion. They can't stop me from practicing medicine. And so the way I navigate that space of being required to give people misinformation is I tell them that I'm required by law to tell you that having an abortion can lead to breast cancer. But my best medical opinion, based on evaluating the evidence and other consensus would support me, is that there's no link between abortion and breast cancer. So they can't stop me from practicing medicine, even when they can inform me and encourage me to misinform people.
Have you ever talked a woman out of an abortion where you felt like she really wasn't ready or hadn't made up her mind in a way that would help her deal with her decision?
For me to talk a woman into or out of an abortion would be a form of coercion, and I don't participate in coercion.
It's her choice, you're saying?
I have encouraged women to gain clarity, and so I have gained a skill at recognizing when someone is ambivalent or they're conflicted, and most of the time that comes out in the form of tears. So if someone's sitting in my office or on my table requesting that I perform an abortion for them, but they're crying, I say, tell me what the tears are about. And so I'm aware that people can be resolute and can be sad or angry about the situation that they're in. So my goal is to discern if a person is, beside being emotionally distraught, if they're resolute, if they're clear about their decision and this feels, and they communicate to me that this is the right decision for them. I've just chosen to trust women. I don't think that regret is the worst thing that you can have. Regret is a function of decision making. It's not a function of what decision you're making. You know, I regret not buying Microsoft in 1985.
Don't we all?
So, but not to make light of it, but it is to say that I think we overestimate the role and the importance of regret because that's a function of thoughtful decision making.
And that's our guest, Dr. Willie Parker. He's got a new book. It's called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. His book is about growing up in Alabama, being the first in his family to go to college, his decision to provide abortions, and how his decision was really empowered by his Christian faith, including Martin Luther King's sermon about the Good Samaritan. And again, you can join the conversation by texting or calling our comment line, and that number is 267-405-2006. Got a lot of comments here, Radio Times at WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do you talk to do men often come with women for an abortion, and do you talk to the men?
For the most part, when women come, there are all kinds of situations. There's certainly women who show up with supportive partners. There are equally a number of women who have been abandoned by their partners, and they are trying to make the material clear the material hurdles. But there are also a number of women who they've chosen to make this decision privately, and they've decided not to inform their partners. And, you know, I've encouraged them, until you have the clarity about what you want to do, don't collect the information or opinions of other folk, and that could include a partner. But for safety purposes, mm-hmm. my caveat is I don't have people in the room who aren't critical to the care. The fact that there have been 11 people killed, four of them providers, part of providing this care and at the same time being mindful of safety means that unless it's an absolutely unique situation, I don't have partners in the room. But I have had men that I've had conversations with in the context of about their partners and try to help them to understand the best way that they can support their partner.
You tell a story of a girl, really, I think she was 12 or 13 years old, who was pregnant in the room, I believe, with her mother, and it turned out it was the father who had gotten her pregnant.
Sure.
Does that happen a lot? I mean, those really, really worrisome family situations.
Probably more than we know.
Yeah.
In this case, in that particular case that you're referring to, it was only by happenstance that we were able to get a disclosure because the mother was there in an effort to conceal right. and to kind of There are all kinds of circumstances that under the context of respecting privacy that facilitate abuse and that encroach upon women's lives. You know, the more tragic ones that come to light that move us. Those stories are probably more prevalent than we know.
Yeah. Where either a woman is frightened of her boyfriend or someone in her life, where she's afraid, I guess, for the future of her children.
Sure. And then it kind of like a silent crisis is, you know, I did a lot of work with sexual assault and intimate partner violence before I became an abortion provider. And we now know that there's a negative interplay between sexual assault and partner violence and birth control sabotage, you know, forced sex, coercive sex as a form of power and control. So there's a correlation between women who are abused physically and higher rates of unintended pregnancy or repeat abortions because mm-hmm. their partners have also been terrorizing them with sex or sabotaging their efforts to use birth control.
You talk in this book about Dr. Gus Nell. This was the abortion provider here in Philadelphia. He's now in prison for murder because mm-hmm. essentially he was murdering almost full-term babies in his office. And apparently from all descriptions, we did a number of shows about it, the office was just a place, a house of horrors, I think is how it was described. You write, Gus Nell is what happens when abortion becomes too difficult to procure and when the occupation itself, abortion provider, is something too socially disreputable for any young idealistic doctor to undertake.
Sure. As a person of color, I've been exposed to the fact that things that we want to shame and stigmatize in a race-conscious society, we racialize them. And when I found that there's a willingness to exceptionalize the positive and extrapolate the negative, it's been very important for people to, because both Dr. Gosnell and I are black men, to say that I'm the second coming of Dr. Gosnell or to draw parallels between him in order to inflame and to distract from the reality that 1 in 3 women in this country will need an abortion, and that by my making care available to them in a respectful and a just and a fair way, that I make sure that misguided individuals like Dr. Gosnell don't make it easy for women to access bad care, because many women who were asked why they went to him, knowing what they knew, they said, because he saw me when nobody else would see me, and he made it affordable. So it's really easy to introduce bombast to short-circuit critical thinking. I'm aware of that. So I don't take offense at all. And if anything, I will playfully say that I'm the counter-narrative Dr. Gosnell. I'm the anti-Dr. Gosnell. Mm. I have a sense of commitment to vulnerable women, many of whom are black and poor, as I come from. And I provide care to them because nobody else will see them.
Almost up on a second break here. What does it cost to get for any person to get an abortion? What does that cost?
Well, on average, I think the cost is about $550. That can vary from place to place. But from an economic analysis standpoint, if you look from 1973 to now, there has not been an incremental inflation rise in the cost of abortion. The cost has largely been fixed because many people who seek to make that access know that women are really being forced to pay for it out of pocket. So it's around about $550.
But if you're a poor person, $500 is a lot of money.
It might as well be $1 billion. That's why we have an abortion fund through the National Network of Abortion Providers, because many women, sometimes the last $50 to $100 can make a difference as to whether or not they'll be able to get their abortion. I think here is the Women's Medical Fund in Philly.
That's Dr. Willie Parker, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his work as an abortion provider, also talking about how his faith has informed his profession, and he's got a new book called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. We've got a lot more comments and calls. Radio Times at WHYY.org. Also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And again, that comment line, 267-405-2006. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Dr. Willie Parker about his new book and his work. Let me play a call to our comment line, and this is Betty.
This is Betty. During this discussion, Marty mentioned the middle ground that could go between all of this talk about abortion. Can the middle ground sometime be that women don't get pregnant by themselves, and the middle ground might be starting to put men in the discussion of abortion and how women, it's a partnership when you have the sad conclusion. It's not just always resting on the woman. Thank you.
Thank you, Betty, for calling into our comment line. We touched on this earlier, but the idea of a greater inclusion of men in this decision, how do you feel about that?
Well, I think It's a freighted and it's a catch 22. Part of the problem with men being involved, when ultimately they are not the person who bears all the risk associated with continuing a pregnancy. If you have a man involved and it's a healthy partnership, that men can be involved would be a great thing, because of the complexity. Women deserve the support through this decision. But there are equally people who are arguing that men have a right to know, and a lot of policies are being crafted and bills being introduced that would allow men to have to give consent for a woman to be involved. I think what the caller is getting at, what Betty's getting at, is I think an acknowledgement of shared responsibility around when pregnancy occurs would go a long way towards decreasing the stigma and shame. But with regard to the middle ground, I'm less committed to trying to find the middle ground, because that requires concessions on both sides. I'm more committed to fostering honest disagreement, because I'm not really interested in proselytizing or changing somebody's mind. You have to change your own mind. But I am interested in introducing facts into the conversation so rather than allowing the void to be filled with misinformation and people who have an agenda about what they think you ought to do regarding pregnancy, let's put reproductive facts into the mix, and then we can have honest disagreement.
You have a chapter here titled Black Genocide and the White Majority. Flesh that out for us.
Okay. So the title's in response to a very a dastardly strategy, in my opinion, that started around 2009. It's popped up before, but it started with billboard campaigns in black communities, like in Philly, New York, and in Atlanta, where They argue that abortion is a genocidal plot conceived by Planned Parenthood and Margaret Sanger to encourage black women to kill black babies and to kill themselves by using dangerous birth control. And it's rooted in the ability to racialize abortion, given that unintended pregnancy and abortion disproportionately happens for black women and poor women. But the absolute number of women who have abortions is greater for white women because they're the larger population group. So I take the disingenuous notion of feigned concern about black women and black babies to ultimately achieve the goal of reducing access to abortion for all women. But it's particularly related to the attempt of white male patriarchs to control the fertility of white women, because if you connect all the dots, there's a race suicide paranoia, particularly as the nation in the world browns. We know in 2050 there'll be no clear-cut numerical majority group, but it will be a nation of minority groups where no group will be more than 50%. And so given that the only person who can have white babies is a white woman, because if a white woman has babies with a non-white man, that baby's not white. If a white man has a baby with non-white women, that baby's not white. The only person who can have white babies is a white man and a white woman. So it's, in my opinion, disingenuous. And pulling the curtain back on the wizard is to say that this whole black genocide noise, as I call it, is really a conspiracy to control the fertility of all women by picking a vulnerable group to conduct this cultural war in the bodies and in the lives of black women, when the same people who say black women should have more babies are the same ones who are cutting off the aid that would be necessary to parent those children.
Well, let me go back to your book in here, and this is where you talk about all these new laws and restrictions about access to abortion. You go on to write, it was whole flanks of the left, among them passionate abortion rights supporters, who found it easy to look away from the plight of their sisters, or who were able to rationalize the new laws as in some way reasonable. Partially this was a result of misbegotten political strategy. I guess the idea that women on the left, perhaps white women on the left, were willing to look the other way when these restrictions went into effect that largely affected women of color, poor women of color.
Sure. Well, you know, the whole notion of the perp walk and the fact that in public spaces, poor women and women of color have to go to the clinics and therefore they can be targeted and vilified and shamed. If we harken back before Roe, when there were ethics committees in hospitals, white women who had doctors who would coach them about how to create a psychiatric indication for abortion were able to have safe abortions in the hospital. Poor women were left to unsafe abortion, such that in New York, when they did the numbers, 70% of all the abortion-related deaths from illegal abortion were black and brown women. Mm. So the fact that we, one, fetishize motherhood, and we think that that's the most primary identity of women, and two, women of means don't have the same barriers. So a woman who lives in Philly, or, well, not in Philly because there are restrictions here, but in New York where there are no waiting periods, Medicaid pays for abortion and the like, that person, if they make motherhood primary, they would say, what's wrong with a 24-hour waiting period? People need to be clear and sure about that decision. But in Mississippi, 24 hours can mean that you can lose your right to have an abortion, and you can lose the one day that you've been able to strategize around getting off your job and providing child care. So it really is a means of folk who were capitulating to the notion of unplanned pregnancy leading to the tragedy of abortion versus the being a public health benefit that kind of has facilitated these laws that now oppress women.
Let me read a text from a New Jersey listener. Said, when I was 5 years old in 1970, my mother was taken to the hospital after bleeding profusely in the bathroom. Later, I found out she almost died from the effects of an illegal abortion. Later, I found out my grandmother almost died from an illegal abortion in the 1930s. Those older all remember the stories of our childhood friends whose mothers died young, many from female problems. That's in quotations. Has anyone researched historical death rates from illegal abortions? Thank you, Dr. Parker, for the work that you do.
Thank you to the question. Absolutely, there are texts that have been able to quantify and to look at the death The maternal mortality, which is the death of a woman in pregnancy that's associated with unsafe abortion. And that's how we know what a life-saving measure abortion is when it became legal, because we know that with the exception of recently where we have better methods of long-acting contraception, where we have fewer unintended pregnancies, the rate of abortion was the same before Roe as after Roe. What fell through the floor was the number of women who died. And again, the statistic I showed you that I cited from New York when they looked at their maternal deaths, because they were one of the first states to legalize abortion, they were able to discern that when they looked at the race and ethnicity of the women who were dying from unsafe abortion, the majority of them were black and brown. And so there have been efforts to look at that, but it's been periodic and spotty between different places.
Let me read an email from Charity who says, listening to your story, I can understand where you get your beliefs from, but I do not agree. Even scientists believe that life starts at conception, so before an egg is completely formed, there's still life. How can you claim to be a Christian if one of the Ten Commandments is, thou shalt not kill? Would you have been able to allow your college girlfriend, if she wanted to become pregnant, terminate the pregnancy?
Well, you know, I hear a lot of and I have a lot of respect for people who disagree with me and who conflate their issues. She cites the Ten Commandments and she infers that this Ten Commandments refer to all life or and therefore refers to a pregnancy. But strangely, the Bible says nothing about abortion. So that people infer and choose to interpret sacred texts in certain ways, you know, it's striking to me that sometimes the people who are most supportive of preventing abortion are also very pro-death penalty. And so it's not a matter of more moral one or the other, but it is to say that when you have a certain religious belief, what is beautiful about religion is when you say that my religious belief prevents me from doing this thing. What becomes problematic is when you say, because of my religious belief, you can't do a thing. And so I respect, you know, the kind of dissent that the questioner poses, but the irrelevance of what I would do personally in the hypothetical that she poses is, it's not about what I would do. It is about what is every woman's right to make a decision about the processes going on in their body. And so you talk about murder happens when you kill a person. You know, we can talk about whether a fetus is a person, but what I need someone to explain to me is, when is a woman not a person? Huh. When is she not entitled to bodily integrity and to control and to make decisions about her life? And I just simply believe that you can't have more interest in a fetus or a reproductive process going on in a woman than you have in that woman herself. How do you give rights to a fetus that you don't take away from the woman carrying it?
Let me put a couple of more calls on the air. The first one is from Karen, and Karen is calling us from, looks like, Williamstown, New Jersey.
Karen, Williamstown, New Jersey. I deeply regret, I'm a person who had abortions as a young woman. I'm now not a young woman. But what I regret most is the sexual behavior that led me to seek abortion, and I still support choice for women of all ages, young and old. Thank you.
And that's Karen calling into our comment line saying, yes, I did have regrets. I mean, she had an abortion. She regrets about the sexual behavior that led to the abortion. As you were saying earlier, we all have regrets, right? When you make a decision, you often will have a regret about something.
I think what I appreciate about Karen's question the most is she shines a lot of light on what people won't acknowledge, and that is the conflation and the stigmatizing and shaming of primary sexuality for women and the sexual situations that they may find themselves in. We have issues around what is legitimate and illegitimate sexuality. A pregnancy is an outcome of sexuality. And what contraception and abortion do is they uncouple sex from procreation. So I think her, what she, the tension that she illuminates, which is very generous of her to share that story, is her supporting choice and realizing that the life she has is related to her ability to make a decision about whether or not the sexual behavior she had, whether it was irresponsible or not, would put her into a life of needing to be a parent, about something she didn't choose. So I think that's part of the tension that we have to navigate, the tension we have about honoring and respecting the primary sexual agency of women in the same way that we do men.
Let me play another one who called our comment line. And this is Susan from Allentown. Do we have Susan?
Good morning. My name is Susan. I'm from Allentown, Pennsylvania, and I just wanted to call in of support for Dr. Parker. I just feel like he's so right on the money with the way we're so afraid of death in this society, and that's why we're afraid of abortion, because we're afraid of death. But there is a moral center, and that is choice. So thank you so much for your wonderful work. I just wanted to call in to support you. Thank you.
Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Anything you want to say to Susan?
Well, I just take, I'm certainly humbled and pleased that she can listen and listen and to think deeply and to decide that she agrees with me. I'm also very encouraged by the fact that I hear youth in her voice and that she is being able to think about this question in a more complex way. And so I'm all about, that's what I want this book to prompt, thoughtfulness around choice. Mm-hmm. I intentionally said a moral argument for choice, not a religious one. And I understand how people raise questions about whether or not I can be Christian, and I get it. When I want to be a little sassy, though, I say, then when they say that I'm not a Christian, I say, neither was Jesus, he was a Jew.
Let me read. Excuse me, one sentence from your book here. Excuse me. Abortion is the only personal decision that is subjected to a high level of government oversight. I mean, it's not done for any other procedure that I know of.
Right. And it's a function of our power base. We can't think of a world beyond patriarchy where men rule and set these sensibilities around how our society is structured. And so this is a gendered vigilance around the important personal decisions. And it, in essence, says that we don't trust women with important decisions the way we do men.
Do you, I think it was President Clinton who said this about abortion, to make it safe, legal, and rare. Would that be your philosophy as well?
It is not my philosophy.
It is not?
Because safe, legal, and rare, for some people that means the only abortion that is safe is one that doesn't happen. But legally, we're doing all we can to make abortion rare. And so it's possible for women to still need abortion and to accomplish all of those goals and to not improve the life or the health or safety of women. I think people get hung up on numbers. I do lots of abortions because I choose to do them exclusively. Why do I choose to step fully into being an abortion provider and provide that? There are women who, if I didn't provide it, they would have no access. So how many abortions? Some people get in, well, one abortion. I have colleagues who say, I'll do one abortion, but I won't do two. Two is a form of birth control. How many abortions will I do? As many as necessary. Because each woman is entitled to make that decision.
Well, Dr. Willie Parker, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And the book is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And he's speaking tonight at the Free Library of Philadelphia. We appreciate all the comments and calls to the show today. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. And we did post some behind-the-scenes photos that you can check out as well. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thanks for joining us.